You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko te ora toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wai Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whai aka nei, coming up on the show today, for our weekly catch-up with the Axe Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government's changes to methane targets and this week's upcoming multi-sector strikes, which is expected to have 100,000 workers walk off the job. And Thursday Wire host Caden spoke to Dr. Kevin E. Trenberth, climate scientist and honorary academic at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Science, about the most pressing climate change-driven threats and the role of New Zealand in enacting solutions. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Principal Scientist at Earth Sciences New Zealand, Dr. Nick Craddock-Henry, about the government's new National Adaptation Framework for Climate Change, what it means for policy, and what holes remain. I also spoke to Associate Professor of History at the University of Auckland, Jennifer Frost, about the No Kings protests in the United States over the weekend and what they mean politically for the country and the Trump administration.
Here at Hofokaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Waimairane gives a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware, e ahe na koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei a pakihiri rokiroki mā rongi te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government has recently reduced biogenic methane emission targets to 14-24% by 2050, changing the reductions passed in 2019 under the Zero Carbon Act of cuts between 24-47% below 2017 levels by 2050. These changes have faced criticisms from the opposition and climate activists and scientists. Green Party co-leader Chloe Swarbrick says this methane denial betrays farmers who are on the front line of climate-driven extreme weather events that threaten global food production and rural livelihoods. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to Court about the target changes. We also discussed this week's multi-sector strike action, which will be attended by workers from various sectors, such as the medical and education sector. Public Service Minister Judith Collins, regarding teachers striking, called the strike action unfair and unwarranted, and said that the union, the New Zealand Post-Primary Teachers Association, or PPTA's primary agenda, was to discuss Palestine with Education Minister Erica Stanford. However, PPTA President Chris Abercrombie disputed this, saying Palestine was one of several topics the union had wanted to discuss with the minister, including AI in education and changes to NCEA. We discussed this, but first, we discussed the government's changes to methane targets. Why are we seeing these changes to methane targets, and how does the party feel about these new targets?
Well, Labor's unscientific climate targets are only ever achievable by shutting down farms and reducing production. And ACT has always stood with farmers with common sense when it comes to emissions reduction and climate change policy. So what we've done with our coalition partners, we commissioned a report as to what should the methane reduction target be so we can actually achieve our goal of 1.5 degrees limit to global warming. And the answer that came back was somewhere in the range of 14-24% reduction in on-farm emissions by 2050. So that's about half or less of what James Shaw and the previous Labor government signed us up to. And so we've said, well, look, let's change the target so we don't put farmers out of business. We don't drive emissions offshore because, of course, if New Zealand farmers aren't growing food and feeding it to other people, selling it to other people, some other farmers will, and we can be pretty sure that they won't be as efficient as we are. And let's make sure that we've got a target that's achievable. So that's what we've done.
These new targets go against the recommendations of the Climate Change Commission, who say that instead of aiming to go essentially carbon neutral, the country should be aiming to be carbon negative. In fact, the government has also pushed back on their legal requirement to respond to the Climate Change Commission's advice on future emission budgets by 2 years. Why is this? Why go against these recommendations? And why push back the government's legal requirement to respond to the Commission's advice?
Well, the Climate Commission is an independent commission. They can come up with their own thoughts and musings about climate policy. But the government also has Ministry for Environment, which is our leading climate policy agency and which supports the Climate Minister Simon Watts and other parts of government when it comes to looking at how we manage emissions and how we adapt to climate change. I think some of the work that the Climate Commission does is helpful, and not all of it is helpful and not all of it is practical. I mean, why would New Zealand choose to become climate negative and impoverish ourselves, put farmers out of business, when that's not a target that any other country in the world has adopted? That would really be smacking ourselves in the face. So no, we won't be taking that advice.
We'll touch on the business side of this move a little bit later, but firstly, I want to touch on a point you made a little bit earlier. A lot of people, unlike what the government says are science-based targets, would say otherwise. Science at the independent Crown entity, whose statutory obligation is to advise the government, say the carbon neutral target is not in line with the Paris Agreement goal of keeping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius. How are these targets science-based?
Well, I understand that different scientists have different opinions as to what policy settings will achieve this outcome. But in the end, New Zealand has to set policies around climate targets that actually allow us to stay in business, to keep people employed, to keep feeding New Zealanders. You know, we are also concerned about the cost of food and how that impacts on people's cost of living. And all of these things need to be taken in balance. Now, no doubt there will be some scientists who think that we could be doing more, but in the end, the government has to pick a pragmatic and common sense approach. And, you know, the advice that we've had is that we can achieve our net zero 2050 target across the economy, a balance of CO2 emissions reductions, methane emissions reductions with the targets we've set.
The New Zealand European Union Free Trade Agreement includes a commitment that we refrain from any action or emission that materially defeats the objective and purpose of the Paris Agreement. This is a similar question I've mentioned in a previous interview, but are you concerned a move like this could impact our relationship with trading partners and New Zealand's sort of clean green image?
Look, I think what's important is that New Zealand focuses on targets that we can realistically and practically meet. We know that we have, in the EU, large customers for New Zealand-produced food, like dairy products. They will be interested in making sure that the farms and farmers and companies that supply them have a credible pathway to meeting their emissions reduction targets. Now, for New Zealand Inc. as a whole, our targets are set based on what we need to achieve as a country. This will really, in the end, be up to farmers and their customers to work out whether they're doing enough.
Despite lower targets, the farming industry will still need to reduce its methane emissions over the next 25 years. How will the government ensure the agricultural sector and the farming sector meet these targets?
Well, there's a number of different ways to do it, and of course there are technologies coming on stream which allow cows, for example, to be inoculated to reduce their methane emissions from their natural gut processes. But the other thing that we might choose to do is to invest in different grasses that cause lower methane outputs from cattle. There's a number of things we can do. But where we're at right now is that we're quite close to achieving the 14% lower band. If we get there in the next 5 to 10 years, then we can review it to see how much more work we need to do to get to the upper band. Yeah, the upper part of the band, the 24% reduction. and there may be some more things we need to do. But let's not forget, we have been experiencing a cost of living crisis, partly pushed by the cost of food, the cost of transporting food, and the last thing we want to do is impose a whole lot of costs on New Zealanders, yeah, through the farming system, that actually do nothing to help global warming in the great scheme of things, and just make New Zealanders poorer. This government won't be doing that. We won't be taxing farmers for their on-farm emissions, and we are confident that the target we have set is achievable in the long term.
On to our next topic, a multi-sector mega-strike is planned for Thursday, with an estimated 100,000 expected to join in on strike action. On the TVNZ's Q&A program, incoming Council of Trade Unions President Sandra Gray says Public Service Minister Judith Collins is trying to drive a wedge between New Zealanders regarding how the country is viewing these strikes, adding that the government is yet to show it has been genuinely prepared to come to the table. What is your view on this?
Well, I'm not surprised that the incoming future leader of the CTU would say that, but she's wrong. This industrial action is unfair to New Zealanders. It's unwarranted, given where doctors and teachers are up to in terms of their pay negotiations. It's estimated that more than 6,000 New Zealanders will have had medical appointments and procedures postponed due to the strike this week. There are people who are living in pain, in fear of what a possible diagnosis that they need will be delayed, which means their treatment will be delayed. That's why this government says this industrial action is unfair. It's unwarranted. And you look at what Health Minister Simeon Brown has done. He's written to the Chair of Health New Zealand and the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, the Doctors Union, asking them to agree to attend binding arbitration over their pay deal. And for the union, please don't proceed with the strike action. Health New Zealand agreed, the unions refused. So when the incoming leader of the CTU says the government's trying to drive a wedge between New Zealanders, I'll tell you what, if you're missing out on seeing a specialist, on getting a diagnosis this week, you can't blame the government. We're doing everything we can to encourage the doctors and to insist on the health agency meet them and actually come to a deal.
With how visible these strikes have been, and if they continue at the rate they have been, are you concerned that younger New Zealanders currently studying and wanting to enter sectors that will be striking on Thursday, such as the education healthcare sector, will instead move overseas and work overseas for what they believe are better pay and working conditions?
Well, that's ludicrous. I mean, the latest pay offer to primary teachers means 66% of them will be paid a base salary of 100 grand within a year of this deal going through. That's increasing from 40% currently up to 66% of primary teachers getting $100,000 a year. I mean, the average wage in New Zealand is only $75,000 a year. So, you know, and then we look at senior doctors. I mean, the latest offer would have provided a salary increase of at least 5% over 2 years, with the ability for additional increases for first-year specialists. And this is in addition to a $5,900 annual step increase that senior doctors receive until they reach the top of the 15-step pay scale. So, you know, it's 5% on top of nearly $6,000 a year they get as of right in the 15-step pay scale. And we're just talking about people who do study hard, do work hard, you know, often put in long hours if you're a doctor or a nurse, but are well compensated for it. And just for context, you know, thinking about people studying now where they might work, well, the private sector wage growth over the last year was 2.3% across the economy. Public sector wages grew 2.8% in the same year, nearly 0.5% more. Now, you might not think 0.5% more comes to much, but the New Zealand government's budget, you know, runs to $160 billion a year. And every time we say we're going to agree to increase public sector wages by more than the rate of inflation and more than what the private sector can pay, we're just sucking money out of the economy, and we can't afford that right now. So look, I think teachers, doctors and nurses, of course, you know, some will say they can always be paid better, but But compared to the private sector and compared to where they were a few years ago, the offer that's been put on the table seems pretty generous.
And additionally, are you concerned that if deals are not made between these multiple unions that are striking and the government regarding pay and working conditions, we could see similar strikes in the future, even strikes with a similar attendance expectancy of 100,000 plus?
Well, if 100,000 teachers, doctors and nurses are not at work this week, you can only imagine how many hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders are not getting taught, are not getting medical care, and not getting the diagnosis that they need to move on to the next stage of, say, cancer treatment. So, look, I mean, we might see more of these strikes, but in the end, these unions are going to have to settle with the government. They're also going to have to settle with Kiwis, whose lives they're disrupting. So, you know, if they think that striking is going to somehow improve the outcome, I think they're wrong, and I think that most New Zealanders this week will be looking upon this pretty horrified by the impacts that these strikes are having on people's lives and really, really puzzled as to why the unions are doing this. I know Minister Judith Collins has said that they do seem to be politically motivated rather than motivated by a desire even to improve pay and conditions, which, you know, when the teachers turned up to visit Minister Erica Stanford a month ago, top of the agenda was Palestine. I mean, these people aren't serious if they're telling you that their most important issue is Palestine, when actually getting in front of kids, making sure that they're learning the basics and making sure that operations and diagnoses are delivered, that's what most Kiwis would have thought these people should be focused on.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on changes to methane targets and the multi-sector strikes happening on Thursday this week.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay, it's BFM.
The Wire. Last week, the government released their first national adaption framework for adapting to climate change. The announcement highlights the risks those in Aotearoa face regarding climate-related disasters and harms, such as floods or storms, as climate change gets worse. This comes alongside a focus on ensuring that Aotearoa's economy is able to withstand, handle, and grow in the face of these risks. While this is a positive step, there remain concerns about how adaption fits in, whether this plan covers all bases, and what still needs to be done. I spoke to Principal Scientist at Earth Sciences New Zealand, Dr. Nick Craddock-Henry, about the framework, its strengths and its drawbacks. To get us started, what exactly does this framework entail?
So the framework kind of outlines 16 actions that the government is going to be taking in order to help us prepare for the impacts and implications of climate change. So the first is kind of, there's four main sort of pillars around sort of improving risk and response information sharing, clarifying roles and responsibilities, investing in risk reduction, and then sort of looking at cost sharing, so pre and post event cost sharing. I think in a lot of ways it provides kind of an important and necessary first step, but there's certainly a lot of work still to be done, both in terms of the science. So one of the key actions, for example, is developing a national flood map, you know, due sort of 2027. So there's still a lot of science to be done, for sure, as well as, I think, probably some work to be done around clarifying exactly how some of this is going to be paid for.
And why is this adaption framework so desperately needed?
The framework is needed because we have seen the accelerating impacts of climate change here in Aotearoa. One doesn't have to look too far back to see how the economic as well as social and livelihood implications of events like the Auckland Anniversary Floods, Cyclone Gabrielle, more frequent and prolonged drought conditions affecting primary industries. These things have a very material effect. So they cost lives, they cost in terms of livelihoods, as well as disruption to critical infrastructure and systems that we rely on every day. So there's definitely a growing need to manage these risks better, to try to reduce current and future economic losses and minimize disruption. But I think it's also necessary because climate change will also create opportunities, and that's probably the sort of the flip side of adaptation that we maybe don't often recognize, is that it will create opportunities, but we have to be in the right position. We have to be prepared. We have to anticipate and identify these opportunities in advance, opportunities both to avoid future losses, so there's an avoided losses component, but also there may be opportunities in terms of land use change. I think there's also an opportunity if we, as a relatively small country, can demonstrate how to adapt successfully. I think that both makes us attractive to overseas investment. It's a safe place to invest because we have processes and systems in place that will minimize disruption and guarantee a return on investment. But I think also if we develop effective tools, if we can develop effective governance and decision-making processes, that also can help us demonstrate, to the rest of the world, how successful and effective adaptation can work in real life.
And in terms of how the framework itself wants to play out, you highlighted some question marks about the economic side and the science side. Could you walk us a little bit more through what these question marks are?
Yeah, I'm probably best placed to speak on the science side. I think the clear economics question is the framework kind of points to pre and post event cost sharing. However, there's a lot currently. Adaptation is the responsibility of local councils. Local councils have very limited means to raise revenue, basically limited to rates. We see already the significant pressure on rates in terms of needing to maintain and invest in existing infrastructure and refresh existing infrastructure, let alone make significant new investments in any protective adaptation measures that may be preferable or that may be required, such as levees, seawalls, and the like. So there is still a significant question in the framework around where the cost will actually sit and how that will be resourced. That's probably a question for the economists and the policymakers. On the science side, however, I think that, yes, the science, the effectiveness or the quality of these adaptation plans for priority areas. So the framework makes it clear that there will be priority areas, that councils need to develop adaptation plans for in the first instance. The National Flood Map will essentially integrate existing information that may be held by local councils. So some local councils have more and less resourcing in terms of being able to develop local flood maps. We'll combine that with national scale data on riverine and coastal flooding to connect all of those models and all of that data in a comprehensive and meaningful way. So essentially those models will be able to talk to each other, and then we will have nationally consistent flood data, which is important for decision making. I think the other thing is that's really important is that scientific information, so that scientific information needs to be credible, it needs to be very robust, so it will go through obviously the normal processes of scientific validation, peer review, etc. So it will be high quality information, but I think it's still important that local decision makers and local communities will need to still have confidence that information is a fair and accurate representation of their own situations. So I think there's a scientific question involved, but there's also, I think, going to be a social issue in that science will need to be trusted, it'll need to be transparent, and it'll be necessary that it reflects both local and national priorities.
And in terms of that science and the framework's obvious focus on adaptation, what sort of areas are missing from this, and what do you want to see kind of come alongside this framework?
Oh, I think the biggest issue for me is absolutely. I think first of all, adaptation and mitigation, we need to think of them as a sort of a unified response, and we can't simply sort of rob Peter to pay Paul, as it were. So I think we need to continue to both aggressively pursue meaningful reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, because if we don't, we will be required to adapt even more. So the more we can reduce those greenhouse gas emissions and ultimately slow the rate at which warming happens, the more effective our adaptation responses will be. So I think that's the first thing, is we need to kind of not see them as binaries or as in opposition, but actually they are complementary. Second, I think the adaptation framework is really only going to be as good as the extent to which it leads to effective action. So I think the framework really does provide the building blocks for a national approach, but unless we act on it, it's simply a framework. So I think that the science can absolutely describe the likely impacts and implications of climate change, and help design with effective adaptation strategies. However, I think there's absolutely still a role for policy to decide what to do with that information. And there's a need for communities, for households, for businesses to understand the risk and then to actually turn any adaptation plans into meaningful action. I think ultimately an enduring framework alone isn't enough. I think there's still going to be a need for science to continue to inform ongoing action and investment as conditions change. But I do think that this is a welcome first step.
That was Principal Scientist at Earth Sciences New Zealand, Dr. Nick Craddock-Henry, on the government's new National Adaption Framework.
I know you must have another question, so I'll shut up.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Whoa, I've never seen so many colours come out of someone's mouth before.
There's more where that came from.
The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra is back. And if you want to see all the colours of the rainbow in one room erupting in wondrous sonic performance, then tune into 95BFM Drive all week, because we've got tickets to give away to the opening night.
The Exploding Rainbow Songbook Volume 4, November 4th, 5th and 6th at Whakamana Cannabis Museum. Tickets available from Mushtix.
You know how everyone has a day one? Like day one at uni, day one of their first job.
Yeah, why?
Well, these filmmakers, they're having their day one. Day one shorts. 8 films from local directors getting their first big break.
What kind of stories?
All sorts. Fertility, ballroom, sweaty hands, even a corporate monster crash out.
Sounds like a bit of me.
All free to watch on YouTube, RNZ and Multi Plus.
I'm checking them out tonight.
Day one shorts. New voices, bold stories. Stream now.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio, for all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio, Thursday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki.
Arcade Radio,
only on 95 BFM.
That was Scared Old Men by Dick Move. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
In a recent article for Newsroom, University of Auckland climate scientist Dr. Kevin E. Trenberth wrote about the continued existential threat of climate change. He outlines the key issues of climate change, including droughts, intense rains and flooding risks and tropical storms, all leading to food and water shortages. In the article, he also called net zero a pipe dream, given the shortfalls of the Paris Agreement and other climate accords. Thursday Wire host Caden spoke to Trenberth, who is a distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, USA, and an honorary academic at the Faculty of Science, University of Auckland, about his article, including the most urgent climate change-driven threats and what role New Zealand has to play in enacting solutions. They started by asking what about the current moment inspired him to write his article.
Well, I've been involved in climate research and following what's going on that for many years, but the latest trends, as you look around the world, are very disconcerting to me. This relates especially to what has always been pressures for people to leave places where they're struggling in Africa and the Middle East in particular, and trying to emigrate to other places, often with rafts or small ships, and some of them, you know, go across the North Sea to the UK, and some of them falter, and there's loss of life as a result. So this has gone on, of course, for quite some time. But there was a period where a lot of countries, and Germany was especially notable, where they were quite welcoming of immigrants of different kinds. And then over the last few years, it seems as though, led especially by the United States, there has been a major clampdown on immigrants. And in fact, in the U.S., they've been exporting people who are there or perceived to be there illegally in various ways. And some of it has been quite vicious, and we see it on the news. But it's not just in the U.S. It's been a turnaround in Germany and in France, and quite a number of other countries have become more authoritarian. And so with pressures from climate change that are always trying to create refugees, in what we might call environmental or climate refugees, then even more of a conflict. And so we look around and we see, in fact, there are many regional conflicts around the world. The biggest ones that have been in the news, of course, have been in the Middle East with Gaza and so on. And also in the Ukraine, but there are many others in Syria and parts of Africa and Ethiopia, in different places, where there have been long-standing, substantial conflicts of different kinds, and so those are the sorts of things that led to my article as raising these as substantial issues. And wondering, you know, what does the future really bring?
One of the biggest threats of climate change that you outline is access to water. Can you speak a bit more about this?
More heat from the increasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. One way that that gets controlled is through evaporation. And of course, that happens over the oceans. So the oceans are not warming as much as the land, but that puts more moisture into the atmosphere. And it means that there's water, and there's probably, I don't know, 10 to 15% more moisture in the atmosphere on a global basis now compared with pre, say, 1970 or thereabouts. And we've got really good measurements of this since about 2000, where there's been about a 7% increase globally. This is a global number. But what happens is when you have a weather system, a storm, it grabs all of the available moisture and pulls it in and creates these things called atmospheric rivers, where suddenly there's a lot more moisture flowing, especially from the subtropics in the case of New Zealand, that produces
flooding events. And we've seen a number of these in New Zealand in particular, you know, really spectacular in 2023 with Cyclone Gabrielle and tremendous floods, unprecedented floods in the Auckland area. But there's been, you know, recent events in the Tasman, in the Nelson region and northern parts of the South Island, and even more recently in Taranaki and other western parts. And many coastal areas are subject to these because the extra moisture in the atmosphere is coming from the ocean.
In your article, and even during this conversation, you've talked a lot about the international nature of climate change. So within this context, what role can New Zealand or New Zealanders play?
Well, certainly we need to keep our own house in order, and I think under the current government, this has not gone very well. This means cutting down on emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But New Zealand's contribution is quite small, and we're very dependent upon other countries around the world for what happens to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because that gets distributed globally over a period of about 2 years. And so we're very dependent upon emissions from the US and China and India. And the biggest increases in recent times have come from China and India. And, you know, we have very little control over that. And so I think the best thing we can do in New Zealand is to recognize that it's out of our control and climate change is happening. And therefore, we need to plan for it. We need to so-called adapt to climate change and build resilience and pay special attention to water and coastal regions where sea level is rising and storm surges cause damage. And so the building really good drainage systems and worrying more about some past settlements of houses that have been built in floodplains without sufficient recognition that in the past there has been major water flows in these areas and the drains have not been put in place to properly cope for that. And so that means that the people who are in those houses are at considerable risk. And it, you know, doesn't all happen at once. It's very much dependent upon individual storms, but sooner or later it happens in your neighborhood, right? And so this is one of the things that New Zealand ought to be paying a lot more attention to.
Is there also a role for New Zealand to accept migrants or refugees who are escaping climate-related disasters?
Well, you know, we've tended to do that, and it's peculiar at the moment, isn't it? Because there have been reports of tens of thousands or even many more New Zealanders leaving New Zealand. And so there's presumably room for more immigrants of various kinds. The question is what skills and education those people bring. And if they're coming from developing countries, maybe some of them are coming from India, some of them are coming from the Philippines or other countries. And so we're swapping a set of educated people who have gone to Australia or elsewhere for people who are less educated. And as a result, you know, what does that do to our GDP? And so this is where the concern with regard to immigrants comes from, is, you know, are they really self-supporting and a benefit to our own economy and well-being?
That was Thursday Wire host Caden speaking to Dr. Kevin E. Trenberth, climate scientist and honorary academic at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Science, about the most pressing climate change-driven threats and the role of New Zealand in enacting solutions.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
That was Army Dreamers by Kate Bush and Know Who You Are at Every Age by the Cocteau Twins. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Over the weekend, a second round of No Kings protests took place across the United States, protesting the anti-democratic actions of the second Trump administration. The previous protests in June saw 5 million join in, and this round had 250 planned protests across all 50 states. Officials in New York estimated crowds of around 100,000 people. Concerns, however, remain around whether or not these protests will do something and whether or not they matter in the face of Trump's authoritarian leanings and actions of his administration. I spoke to Associate Professor of History at the University of Auckland, Jennifer Frost, about these protests and what they say about political attitudes towards Trump in the United States. To get us started, what sort of scenes were we seeing over the weekend?
Well, first, Alex, I'd like to just say the numbers are being estimated closer to 7 million people coming out to protest this weekend, and upwards to even 8.7 million estimates. It's very hard to get estimates on these. And yes, absolutely right. There were protests all around the country, but also all around the globe. So there were protests in multiple countries, from, you know, Germany to South Korea to the United Kingdom. So there really was a great showing this weekend. The other thing is there was an estimated at least 2,600 protests planned. So it, you know, some states like, Kentucky or Montana or Missouri, where these are red states and you don't expect protests, having multiple protests, not just in their, you know, blue Democratic-led cities. So I think the breadth and the depth of the protests were incredibly significant, and they're saying it's the second largest protests in U.S. history. I think the other thing is the participants just ranged all across the board, from young to old, to people of all different ethnicities and genders. And I think that breadth really, and that diversity was really important. I think the messaging also was just incredible. So one of the things in the lead up to this No Kings, so the first No Kings in June, the Republicans and Trump really didn't pay attention to what was happening. But for this one, they did an all-out communication war against the protests, saying that they were going to be violent, that they were going to be dominated by terrorists. And instead, these protests, which were planned to be nonviolent, were overwhelmingly nonviolent. No arrests made in cities like, you know, New York and Los Angeles. And in fact, police departments coming out and saying exactly that, you know, thank you for the nonviolent protest. So really proving the Republican leadership and Trump completely wrong. The other messaging they had was that people were being paid, and a lot of social media folks and media folks were out there asking people, you know, have you been paid? Have you been paid? And people saying, no, no. And, you know, one woman even said, you'd have to pay me not to protest. So I think that was really an important counter message to what the Trump regime has been saying.
Now, in terms of just like the core messaging of the No Kings protest, what exactly are they actually protesting about the Trump administration?
Yeah, good. I think this is where, and we've got to give credit to Indivisible, which is a nonprofit, nonviolent network of local groups in the United States, which got started after the first Trump victory in 2016. And so they really believe in decentralized protest. And I think this is really important. Obviously, the United States is a huge country, but by having so many different locally led protests, you know, it's much more challenging to the regime than if it was one sort of centrally led protest. So I think that was important. And then they've played with different rhetoric, but the No Kings or messaging, the No Kings has really taken off because it's such a simple message and plays into, you know, U.S. History and U.S. patriotism. You know, from our perspective here in Aotearoa, you know, New Zealand, it seems a bit cringy at times, but this kind of language is, you know, the United States is not a place of monarchs. It's a place of the people. You know, in the United States, the people have sovereignty, the authority and power to govern. That really plays with Americans. So one of the things in the, you know, the GOPers saying that these rallies and protests were going to be anti-American, the response was of the protesters, let's reclaim the messaging of American patriotism. So bring our flags, you know, say we the people, which is the first, which are the first three words in the U.S. Constitution. You know, we the people are here. And I think that messaging is just, it's very simple, but it's very powerful, and it resonates both with history and with the present, as Trump is frankly an authoritarian, and he and his supporters, both in the courts and really the Supreme Court, in Congress, and in his regime, have been just relentlessly breaking the law and breaking the Constitution. So it's a really important message.
And I mean, going back to both the overwhelming nonviolence and the positive sort of messaging of these protests, what role can we expect to see these parts of the protest play in whether or not this will do anything?
Yeah, I'm absolutely positive it not only will do something, it is doing something. So in the first instance, it's demonstrating that Trump is not popular. And we've got to remember that he did not win a majority of the vote, of the electorate. He won a plurality. In fact, more people didn't vote in the last 2024 election than voted for Trump. So I think always remembering that is very important. It looks like a landslide because of our electoral college, which, you know, kind of distorts the way in which it looks. And he won by, you know, a little bit over 1%. So it's reminding people that he is not popular, and the policies that they are pursuing are overwhelmingly not popular. And that does matter in the United States, even at this fragile moment for U.S. democracy. But I think the other really important point is that just by coming out and protesting, you are saying that you're not accepting this authoritarian regime. You're not going to bow down to what the regime is trying to do. And instead, also building solidarity with one another, demonstrating that, yes, in this day and age, you know, people still have agency, still have power. And in fact, one of the more, you know, kind of scary messages that was coming out is, you know, protest while you still have the right to do it. But, you know, here you have Americans happily using their constitutional rights to free speech, to assembly, to petitioning the government when they're not happy with it. And it is important to use these constitutional rights and show the value of them. The other thing is, it just was, you can see people are having fun. They are singing, they're dancing, they're carrying funny signs. One big theme that's happening and developing is these inflatable costumes. And it started in Portland against ICE. And the deployment there of ICE, and it started with a Portland frog, and it's just taken off. And in all these places, you have these inflatables coming out, and it's whimsical, it's funny, but it also opposes and really brings into high relief the inhumanity, the ugliness, the hostility of the Trump regime and what they're doing through ICE. Through their border patrol, et cetera. So, I mean, it's just creative, and it brings people together in a really positive way. And everything I'm seeing, and from, you know, my sister, for example, who participated in Santa Cruz, California, you know, it made people really happy to see how many of their fellow Americans agree with them in opposing this regime.
What can we expect to see going forward now from these protests?
Well, I think there will be more. So that's one thing for sure. There definitely will be more protests. The protests have definitely angered Trump because he's, you know, remarkably thin-skinned given how powerful he is. And that's always good to make him feel a little more insecure. But I think the other thing we need to realize is that these protests, and really from the beginning, have helped to embolden the political opposition among Democrats, but also among Republicans, too, against the Trump regime. So you're starting to see, you know, both the Democratic Party politicians standing up. You're also seeing Republicans, too, pushing back at some of these things. For example, the Trump regime, you know, killing fishermen, you know, off the coast of Venezuela and Colombia. So there's a bipartisan legislation right now in Congress saying that he can't do that. So it's emboldening the political opposition. It's actually emboldening the media, because the media has been kind of bowing down to Trump in so many ways, not the alternative media, but the mainstream media. But just last week, the media who cover the Pentagon, the Defense Department, walked out because they refused to accept the restrictions on their access. And we're also seeing, of course, the lower courts push back, universities are pushing back, and we have elections coming up on November 4th. And so really important governor races in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, New Jersey and Virginia. In Pennsylvania, there's a really important Supreme Court race. So that's going to be, we're hoping that this also mobilizes Americans to vote, and Americans in Aotearoa can also vote from abroad. And I think that's really an important thing to do. So, and then we have Mamdani running for mayor in New York City. And so it's likely he will win, but that will be a really important victory. And one of the things that everybody's talking about, these protests are really important to demonstrate, you know, resistance and opposition to authoritarianism. But we also need to think about, what are we working toward? And the kind of organizing that's happening in these communities, bottom up, bringing people together, is also about possibility, you know, and how do we want to go forward? How do we want to envision our future? And that kind of work needs to happen on the local level. So with any luck, these protests are kind of the grounding of not just resistance and opposition, but of possibility and moving forward into the future.
That was Associate Professor of History at the University of Auckland, Jennifer Frost, on the No Kings protests in the US over the weekend and why they matter.
That was The Wire.
Koira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korido mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Earth Sciences New Zealand's Dr. Nick Craddock-Henry, and the University of Auckland's Dr. Kevin E. Trenberth and Jennifer Frost. Nei reo hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sarah, covering for Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.